Hello and welcome to this week's instalment of Nucleus Investment Insights. On the 11th of May this year, Treasurer Josh Frydenberg handed down his second pandemic budget amidst a backdrop of continuing uncertainty. Acknowledging that the virus is a continuing threat to lives and livelihoods, this budget is again framed to prioritise jobs and investment. As well as stimulus measures, the focus has been on structural reforms across many of the government portfolios. Skills, infrastructure, deregulation and digital transformation are all featured, together with a continued emphasis on services. The current and projected hit to immigration, one of Australia's favourite growth levers, has seen our per capita income look remarkable as labour market tightens and more jobs are serviced by local unemployment. There is one main takeaway, however, and it's that budget deficits are here to stay. As we'll cover off more in the show, our decade-long run of big budget deficits will continue, taking advantage of the extraordinary low interest rate environment we find ourselves in. But where is this money going to come from? In normal times, central banks want to keep their independence from spendthrift governments to fortify their inflation-fighting credibility. For now, however, the RBA appears to be in lockstep with Canberra in keeping their foot flat on the expansionary pedal. We take some time today to assess and summarise our take on the budget and consider if we stand at a post-pandemic turning point or run the risk of falling back into the poor policies of the past. Joining us today to share his views is our Chief Economist, Leith Van Onselen. Hello to you, Leith.
G'day, Tim. Hi, everyone.
Great to have you back on the show, and also here to share his thoughts on the investment impacts of the 2021 budget and how we reflect this in our portfolios. We have Nucleus Wealth's Head of Investments, Damien Klassen. Hello, Damien.
Hi, Tim.
Great to have you on as well. Just a quick reminder that before we get started, if you haven't already, please subscribe and click on the notification bell to be notified of when we go live or have a new webinar to watch, or follow us on your preferred podcast platform. We also ask if you'd like to take a moment to click like on the video now to help our show grow. And for those listening in live, feel free to drop in your questions in the YouTube live stream chat to have them answered along the way. So we'll jump into the agenda for today. So we're going to kick off with some key budget parameters. We'll then roll into a decade of budget deficits and whether or not it matters. And then, of course, a return to perhaps Big Australia, so the numbers may indicate. So let's fire off. Leith, if you'd like to perhaps pick up on the key budget parameters.
Yeah, thanks, Tim. Thanks, everyone. There's two ways to look at the federal budget. First of all, it's obviously the budget is basically the sum of budget measures, individual policy decisions made that obviously affect us. Whether it's increasing investment in infrastructure, on health, education, etc. And on that count, the federal budget from a macro perspective was very expansionary. Basically, the federal government has done away with its austerity drive of the Abbott years, its desire to head back to a budget surplus as quickly as possible. And it's basically projected a decade of budget deficits ahead. It committed to a whole bunch of different spending initiatives, whether it's increasing funding for aged care, the NDIS, infrastructure, a whole bunch of other little areas which add up to some very big money. I won't comment on those individually, except to say that by and large, I thought it was an appropriate budget from a spending perspective. Given that we're coming out of the COVID recession, the last thing we need to do is obviously return to austerity and try and return to budget surplus. All that would do is obviously drive up unemployment and stifle the recovery. Instead, the Morrison government's really produced more of a Labor Party type budget. And is going to maintain the deficit borrowing for another decade in order to try and pump prime the economy and to try and drive unemployment lower, and also hopefully wage growth higher. Now the Treasury's forecast in the budget were for a slightly slower economic growth going forward in an aggregate sense. However, what's not stated, but was stated separately from the Treasury head, Stephen Kenny, in a separate speech, is that our per capita growth is actually on a higher trajectory. The Reserve Bank of Australia has made the same assessment, and that's purely because immigration has turned negative and the population growth slowed from about 1.5% per annum to about 0.1%. And because of that, although the overall economy is projected to grow not quite as fast, everyone's slice of the pie is actually going to grow at a faster rate, which is actually good news. The strange thing that unemployment is projected to fall to about 4.5% at the end of their forward estimates. So that's over the next 4 years, which is what Treasury says is needed in order to drive wage growth. Mm. Curiously, however, after spending a decade pretty much of every single budget when we ran very high rates of immigration, Treasury for the past previous 10 budgets before COVID basically said that wages were going to grow very quickly in the years ahead. It never did. They actually fell. Yet now that immigration's fallen, Treasury has projected real wage declines over the next couple of years. And in fact, wages won't return until the big Australia migration is returned in 4 years' time, which is very curious indeed, given that there's widespread reporting now of labour shortages across the economy because we're not having all the extra people come in.
And is there any basis for that? Why suddenly the about face and, you know, it goes against
them? Well,
I don't know, but I don't think it's changed. They're just basically, their model's just... They've had the wrong model, and so the model used to say things were going to go well, and now the model's saying things are going to go badly. But the question is, they need to step back and question their model.
Exactly. Yeah, Damien's spot on. So my reading of the situation, having not seen the Treasury model, I wish I'd looked at it when I was working there 15 years ago, but I just never bothered because it was incredibly boring. But you know, I wish I had. If I could go back in time, I would look at it, because my assumption, my guess is that Treasury's budget model assumes that higher rates of immigration equals higher wage growth, which is why in the pre-COVID budgets, they'd always predicted that wages would grow fast when immigration was fast. Now that immigration's turned negative, it's predicting falling real wages. So it's completely back to front with reality.
And how long do they need to be wrong before they reevaluate their model?
Well, they are thinking a lot about it, which is a good thing. Yeah. So you know, I guess hopefully they'll come up with the right answer at some stage, but I think the issue is they've certainly gone from yeah, everything will be right, it'll just return to trend, to like, just a minute, maybe we've got this wrong.
Yep.
Maybe wage growth isn't going to be as fast as we thought. Maybe we need to have a bit more of a think about how we're doing it. So they're certainly thinking about it, and I think, you know, obviously what Leith's writing, you know, on a day-to-day basis is hopefully helping at some stage. And yeah, you know, and you are seeing it within economic commentators now. There's people like Giddens and stuff like that.
Absolutely, yeah. Giddens, Gareth Ed's always been excellent on it. But there's a whole bunch of economists, Solis, like pretty much every day now, Stephen Kokoulis, a whole bunch of economists now are saying that with the labour, with the borders shut and the labour market tightening because firms can't just grab a foreign worker whenever they want it, wages are going to grow. It's a very simple equation. For 10 years, Australia added 180,000 to 200,000 new workers every year through migration. Well, that obviously adds to labour supply, and it makes it a lot harder to bring the unemployment rate down, and it leads to other things equal lower wage growth. So now that fact is gone, the labour market's tightening, and now business is going to have to pay more. And this is the reason why we've got all the business lobbies squealing so hard.
Yeah.
For a return to immigration, because businesses want three things. They want more people to sell to, you get that through immigration. They want to pay the workers less, you get that through immigration. And they want lower taxes, which you obviously don't get. But two out of three ain't bad, as Meatloaf said. And that's basically what they're after.
Yeah. Now let's put our investment hats on as well from the other direction. Is there's a bunch of companies in Australia who've done very, very well out of this. And as you said, that's their business model, is lobby the government to pump more money into, is to bring in more immigrants, sell more, open more stores, keep your
sell more apartments,
keep your wage costs low. Those companies haven't got yet to be seen. But at the moment, they're probably not facing the same environment. I mean, it does look as if Morrison would like to open the taps again. So there is some question mark over that. So I guess what I'm saying is, you don't want to swing the whole opposite direction and go, hey, you know, your Harvey Normans and those guys are now going to be are now going to go through a decade of struggles. They've sort of had this decade of the wind at their back and facing the, you know, they're going to headwind because maybe in 6 months' time, you know, the gates are open again, and you know, Australia's done really well out of the coronavirus, and maybe there's even more immigration than what we had before. But I don't know. I guess let me. So I guess what I'm saying is I'm looking at this as it, from an investment perspective, going, okay, this could be a bad thing for a number of companies that have done really, really well out of the whole immigration bit. And so you want to be getting out of those companies into different ones. But the flip side is maybe those guys are. It's just you just got to bide time for 6 months or 12 months until the gates are open again, and then it's game on again.
Well, certainly that's what they're hoping for, and I think that's why they're lobbying so hard to have them to return to the status quo of pre-COVID levels of immigration, because they obviously want to protect their business model.
Yep.
And you're seeing it right across the board. You're seeing it not just in the small hospitality players, who are obviously ground zero for wage theft and paying incredibly low wages. They want it back, but it's more the you've seen it with the Australian Industry Group, Business Council Australia, all the big CEDA, all the big business lobbies are, you know, lobbying very, very hard to basically get back to what worked previously, because it's, you know, it's a no-brainer for them. It's a very, very easy way to grow your business when you just have your customer base growing at you know, about 2% every year, 1.5% through immigration. And then as well, obviously, you've got a, you know, ever-expanding pool of labour to recruit from, which you can pay lower wages for. So it's yeah, it's a no-brainer for them. But just to bring us back to the budget, if we just skip along to the...
Because I just want to stick with the investment. Oh, this is the investment theme. Because for me, this is quite important for anyone, as an Australian investor, trying to get to the bottom of what do you do in the back of this. And it seems as if this budget... It doesn't really, what it's showing, I guess, in a way, and the economic stats, it's probably more the economic stats are showing that things have changed. It looks like per capita is better. All of a sudden we've got, you know, politicians talking about per capita, whereas, you know, 2 years ago, mate, per capita was wasn't even in their dictionary as to what it was. Well, it's all about saying...
Because we're running a per capita recession back then.
Exactly.
And nobody wants to mention that.
Yeah. They just want to say, oh, look at the headline growth. Look at the headline growth. Don't worry about per person. Yeah. So... And as you said, there's a lot of economists there, but the flip side is, you know, so I guess I sort of look at it with the cynical hat of going, okay, so on one side, we've got a bunch of economists saying, hey, this is a really good thing that we're making these wage gains. And on the other side, you've got a bunch of business lobbies saying, this is terrible that people are getting higher wages. You know, we need to get back to lower wages and jam more people in. And our cities are empty. And so we need more people to fill up these cities and get our property prices, you know, our commercial property prices back up and all that. It would seem to me cynically that economists don't donate that much to political parties, whereas business lobbies do.
Yeah, and in fact, the economists that do push this agenda tend to be employed by those same lobbyists.
Right.
So you know, whether you're an economist working at the you know, Chamber of Commerce or one of the property lobby groups or whatever, those are the ones who you hear about a lot, who are always pushing this line. But the independent ones, for some reason, they have been very silent for a decade. They never really questioned it. But now they're starting to question it. They'll probably just get ignored.
It's probably only so long you can bang the drum before, you know, you get drowned out. Well, and now you've got a case to stand up to it again, because we've got low immigration and the numbers are working.
Yes, but I guess as well... it seems to me that the sort of embedded within this budget is this whole part about, okay, maybe deficits aren't bad. We've spent 10 years telling you deficits are terrible. You know, don't let labor in, deficits are terrible. And then they're like, well, you know, maybe we can run some debt. You know, it's not gonna hurt that much. So they've obviously had a flip of internally that they've actually sort of gone, okay, this is now a narrative that we're going to start pushing is that deficits aren't that bad. We need to run them. It's going to help. Okay, so they've done that flip. There is potential maybe they'll do the flip on the immigration as well and say, hey, and especially as there's this whole, you know, I think Scott Morrison seems to have found a new religion of it, from open everything up as fast as possible. Now he's like, hey, wow, those guys, you know, closing things down gets you lots of votes. Maybe I'm now.
It's incredibly popular.
Exactly. Yeah. Maybe now I'm for closed borders, you know. So I guess I'm just trying to walk this. I guess I'm completely unsure as to which way this is going to go.
So am I. Look, I'll tell you one thing. I am perpetually wrong when it comes to this sort of policy. Now, I'm not saying I'm wrong in what I'm arguing, but every time I've taken a stand on a policy issue, whether it's negative gearing, not lifting the superannuation guarantee, you name it, I've never gotten what I wanted. So the fact I'm arguing this means I probably won't get it again because that's just the system we've got. But it doesn't mean I'm not going to fight it.
No, that's right. But it's a question about saying.
But I'm also incredibly cynical.
We will come back to super as well later. But from an investment perspective, I'm very much looking at this going, this could be the end of the road for a number of business models if we went this part. But it really should be too.
Absolutely. And one only needs to look across the pond at New Zealand. I mean the Ardern government, which is about as left as you can get, but it's also incredibly popular. It's just basically dropped the hammer saying no more big New Zealand. They've said they're going to cut the numbers and they're going to focus on just, keep the family immigration the same, but just focus on high-skilled, high-quality immigration going forward. Mm. Because they've acknowledged that the model they've run, which is pretty much identical to ours, has just led to overloaded infrastructure and housing, and it's put downward pressure on wages. And it's meant that employers have basically not been training New Zealanders and not been employing New Zealanders. So what I'm hoping will happen is Labor will have a quarter of a brain and will say, oh, hang on. Yeah. Jacinda Ardern, which is doing a much better job than us, is way more popular and is actually in government, has just done this in New Zealand. We should copy her.
Yeah.
Copy her policy thing approach. But we'll see.
That sounds awfully like taking a stand on an issue, which doesn't seem to be
it's not the Australian modus operandi.
Well, last election, Shorten did, but got punished for it. So I guess where I'm sort of leading to this is that, even on that front, is that I think that sounds, I like what you're saying there in terms of it's an interesting test of a model as well. But the results, let's say Australia goes back to big immigration and New Zealand doesn't, and New Zealand does a lot better on a per capita basis. We're not going to see those results for 3 or 4 years.
No, that's right.
That's ages away. And the old model
will already be re-embedded.
Yeah.
That's the interesting thing. But can I just swing one forward?
Yeah.
I didn't mean to hijack the whole budget thing on immigration, but it is actually a fundamental.
I think what we're trying to do as well with the podcast as well is we're not trying to say this is what happened with the budget because there's plenty of people doing that. What we're trying to do is this is what happened to the budget and this is what it means for investment markets. So
yeah, for sure.
So yeah, so let's sort of delve deeper into some of these. How does it affect investment? But yeah.
So there's a really interesting chart. Some charts that come out of the budget and they actually show how much the Australian labour market has tightened with closed borders now. The chart on the left basically shows the proportion of
ratio of unemployed to vacancies and advertisements.
That's right. I'm not wearing my glasses, guys. So I'm trying. The screen's too far away.
Better make it a bit bigger.
It's just blurred
for old man Leith.
Yeah, that's right. But anyway, the basically showing that the labour market is the most tight that it's been since the global pre GFC. So it's incredibly tight, and that's a good thing because a tight labour market means that there's more competition for workers, and which means we're more likely to get wage growth.
Well, can I also preface this by saying that period you've got drawn on there is a period of very weak wage growth.
Yep.
Mm. So, the fact that it's tight relative to the last, 10 years. Actually doesn't mean that much in terms of, like, that doesn't mean there's a wage explosion coming.
No, absolutely not. But at least it's going the right way.
We might climb off the floor.
Yeah, that's it.
But I guess where I'm getting to with that is, the US under Trump was running unemployment rates of 3.5% prior to COVID and weren't seeing wage inflation.
Yeah.
Mm. And so the concept that a lot of economists have had, or most central banks have had, is like, oh, once you hit, once you get into the fours, high fours, then you're going to start getting inflation. Yep. And then that's they're like, okay, now it's the low fours. Now it's the high threes. Oh, now it's the mid threes. And they're like, well, okay, maybe it's twos. And then the coronavirus happened and they never really saw. But I guess where I'm getting to is there's something in that the point at which wage inflation takes off, given now we've got a much more integrated world and with a lot of work from home now, you can start hiring people overseas that are doing, and keeping wages down, is that we really don't know where wage growth is going to take off. And every central bank's forecast for the last 10 years has been wrong in terms of, and wildly wrong in terms of, like, it's not
just the rate of unemployment.
It's not just the RBA, which, and we haven't managed to get our unemployment down anywhere near what the US has. Right around the world, they're like, oh, maybe it's lower, maybe it's lower, maybe it's lower.
Yeah, and Treasury's latest guess now is 4.5%. And the RBA is sort of saying under 4.5% as well is where you'll start seeing wage growth. But again, that's a guess.
Yeah, and the first corollary is the US, where it got to 3.5% under Trump and no wage growth, or very little wage inflation.
But at least what these charts show is that basically employment growth is going to return pretty much to the pre-COVID trend, according to Treasuries. And that's without big migration, so that's good. The vacancies are incredibly tight, like tightest in more than 10 years. And the forecast unemployment rate is obviously going to fall to the lowest since the GFC. So so all the indicators there are good in terms of, you know, for hopefully getting some wage growth. But again, strangely, the Treasury's predicted negative real wage growth, at least for the next, next year, and then zero real wage growth for the 2 years after that, which is a bit strange.
So that's sort of coming back to saying, you know, it's quite possible then, if wage growth is stronger than what they're forecasting by keeping borders closed, then the budget deficit's not going to look as bad. What are they forecasting for when immigrants return though?
For wage growth.
When do they say the immigration taps get turned back on, and how high?
So there's a chart in a few years' time. A few slides' time. The one after that. Next one. There we go. So it's a top. It's a top row there. Basically, it's not till 2025 before it gets back to what's
200 plus.
What's basically pre-COVID levels. So basically negative this financial year, negative next financial year, 90-something thousand the following one, and then over 200.
Taps are open.
That's it.
Let it run.
So back to big Australia.
Because I guess what I'm saying though is that where I'm getting to with this is one of the benefits from not that I think deficits are important, but if you've got more people coming in, then you get to spread the deficit amongst more people.
Yeah, especially if you don't do the spending to then keep up with the population growth, which has been Australia's model. Bring them in, collect the extra company and personal tax.
Don't build extra roads, hospitals and all that type of stuff. Let the existing ones jam full and
get a free ride on the falling lifestyle.
That's it.
Yeah.
Australia's modus operandi.
Yeah. But you know, we've got a 3-year chance to catch up now, Leith, and then we can do it all over again. We can build a few more, you know, we catch up to the growth we had before, and then we can just jam the, you know, we can get back to capacity levels at these things from 110% back to 95%, and then you can start the immigration again and jam it back up to 110%.
Just in time for the Westgate Tunnel to be finished in 4 years' time or whatever. Start going nuts.
Okay. So, yeah, I guess I'm just trying to hit that up on a, like, where if they're wrong on the size of the deficit, it's probably they're probably overcooking how big the deficit's going to be. Well, unless we see the iron ore price fall away.
Well, actually, the budget's incredibly pessimistic on the iron ore price. So they've basically forecast $55 for next year. Okay. So if anything, I think they've been as you said, they're overstating the deficit.
Because if we get a bit more wage growth than what they're expecting, then...
And also, obviously, I'd almost put money that the iron ore price is going to be above $55 in the next 12 months.
I think the average price will almost certainly be above it.
Yes. Yeah. So based on that, they're going to get more company tax receipts as well. Yeah. So I think they're probably being a little bit pessimistic. Jaden, can we just go back a couple slides? There we go.
Just putting that in perspective for people, the iron ore price is currently 220 or 230, whatever it is from the, it's right up there.
And it's basically showered the federal budget with an extra $20 to $30 billion of revenue. So it's been rivers of gold, and also the WA budget's projecting a $5 billion surplus this year.
Yeah,
just on the back of iron ore.
And I'll tell you why I'm leading in this direction. So that as you get just about to get into these budget deficits, is from an investment perspective, one of the most important things is saying how stimulatory is the budget going to be. A decent guide is how big is the deficit and the forward guidance. So I guess what I'm saying is if the if the forward guidance for these budget deficits is nowhere near as big as what it might look like today, then it's not as stimulatory as you might think it is. Mm. And that's one part. And then the and then the other part is that a lot of the deficits or the presumed deficits are based around company tax bring forwards and things where you basically say, okay, well, you can accelerate depreciation, which it's like basically saying, okay, you're going to pay $100 million or whatever it is, $1 billion. You're going to pay $1 billion in this tax over the next. Actually, no. Maybe other things are up. $10 billion. How much is in there? $30 billion. Yeah. Wasn't it? You're going to pay $30 billion over the next 5 years in this tax. We'll let you
write off.
We'll let you write that all off rather than being $6 billion. You get $6 billion a year of tax write off. You can take it all in year one, and so that's great. And that is a benefit. But what it means is that next year, your $6 billion
that you would have
better off.
Yeah, companies are paying $6 billion more in tax than what they would have because they've already taken that.
Yeah.
And so the stimulus is very front-loaded. And so you're actually withdrawing stimulus every year, even though you're not doing anything. Mm. There's actually a net withdrawal relative to a normal baseline.
Yep.
And so where I'm leading to is this, is that it's potentially, and front-loading is a good thing, but...
great for election cycles, I'm sure.
Yeah, but it's just worth noting that, looking forward 10 years and saying there's budget deficits as far as the eye can see, there's going to be stimulus for 10 years, this is going to be net bringing more and more money into the economy every year for 10 years, is actually, probably is, but it's probably probably nowhere near as big as what you might think it is looking at the headline numbers.
Yep.
And so this year's numbers are pretty accurate, but when you start looking at forward years, you start going, okay, well, maybe it's just not as stimulatory as you might have thought at first glance.
Well, just on that, the left-hand side chart, if anyone's watching this live, I can see that basically this is Treasury's projected budget deficits over the next sort of 10 years. And as you can see, those budget deficits as a share of GDP continue to fall over the forward period. Mm-hmm. So it's projected to be about, I think, 34% of GDP this financial year, next financial year. It's going to increase, top out at about 41% of GDP, and then fall back to 37% of GDP by 2032.
Yeah, which with, you might be worried about that as, going, oh, no, our debt's going up, and then future generations and all that. But this is like chicken feed compared to any other economy just about in the world. Like, US is talking about 100%, and Japan's in the 250s, and China's, right up there as well. Like, it's not...
It's tiny.
And that's an important frame of reference, though, isn't it? That, like, what we're talking about here, whilst it's big in relation to our history, there's still a lot further that it could go if it wanted to.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And it's the part about going, if you're... you're adding 5% to your debt to GDP ratio, and your current debt's only 15%, and you're like, oh, it's a 33% increase in the number in the amount of debt.
Yeah.
Whereas
it's a rounding error in another country.
If you're already at 100% and you're adding another 5%, that's a 5% increase in the debt. But it's the same net spend in that year.
Yeah.
So
sure.
So you just got to keep that in mind. Is that what's important is not as much the stock, more about the flow of what is that deficit on a year-to-year basis. Yeah.
And of course, it also matters. I mean, the key in all this, whether or not you've got a mortgage or... I'm not trying to say that budget deficits are anything like a household balance sheet. They're not. Totally different. Government can print their own money. But the point is, it's the cost of servicing that debt, right? So if you've got $1 million mortgage and you're paying a 5% mortgage rate, then it goes down to 2.5%, obviously... Mm. It's going to be a lot easier service.
Yeah,
and have more money to spend or pay.
That's
off
right, and interest rates are obviously incredibly low. The government's always can use the RBA to monetize it. And in fact, if we just skip along the next chart,
and governments in theory last for infinity.
Oh, that's right,
or certainly a very long time. So way longer than your average household. You got to pay your mortgage down before you retire, or before you die, I suppose. But whereas governments are sort of like
in perpetuity.
Theory, it's, if they don't pay the debt, it's not an issue really, because inflation rises and tax rises.
And this these charts I took from Stephen Kenny, that's the Treasury Secretary's speech post budget about two nights ago. It really encapsulates the issue. Basically, it shows that despite the fact that the stock of debt is going to rise, or has risen and is going to rise quite substantially, the actual interest payments, so the cost of servicing that debt's only about 1% of GDP going forward.
Yeah.
And so, once you account for nominal GDP growth, it's actually a negative real interest rate. So
So just to put in this for anyone listening in, so the chart on the left there is basically showing there's a blue line showing some that the amount of interest paid as a percentage of GDP, you know, in the 1980s sort of hit 3% of GDP, and then it sort of just pretty much faded down to maybe 0.5% of GDP in the Howard years.
Yeah.
And it's climbed up to 1% last year, and it's basically staying there. You know, there's a very slight increase over in the forecast years. It's basically not changing.
Yeah.
So despite the
debt, decades.
Yeah. Mm. Despite the debt increasing a fair bit, there's basically, you know, very little change in the cost.
Yeah, so it's kind of akin to doubling your mortgage but halving your interest rate. Not including paying back principal, obviously. So it's basically, you know, it's line ball the same. 1% of GDP into, you know, a decade or so ahead.
Yeah.
And in fact, once you account for inflation, or the GDP deflator, as they call it, it's actually negative. So because nominal GDP will probably rise by about 5% plus a year.
Just on that, though, because, you know, look, that's the public sort of perception is, oh, the debt, how are we going to pay for it? And obviously there's state.
What about the children? Federal.
Yeah, you know, and that's a commonly, I don't know, often trotted out trope almost, it feels like, which maybe the right, you know, the right side of politics are probably backing off on now, considering that they're pretty good at doing it.
Well, they're forced into it by COVID.
Yep. But, and, you know, look, it's sort of interesting whether or not, I guess over time, maybe if people stop talking about it, it won't become such a big issue and a political football that it is, because, you know, everyone's doing it now. There's no...
Yeah, you know. I'd argue that there's a... that this is a... It's something that is a convenient thing for politicians to complain about when they're in opposition.
Yep.
And so... But more importantly, it's something that... the right-wing parties will complain about in opposition. So you saw in the US, you know, complaints left, right, and center about it for all the Obama years, and then as soon as Trump was in, running way bigger deficits and, yeah, and spending way more money, but, you know, you didn't get a peep out of the people who were all the people who were complaining about it before were like, yes, tax cuts, unfunded tax cuts, done.
Yeah.
That started to flip back around. People, a few of them complain, and they're voting against stuff because they go, oh no, we can't afford that. You know, we can't afford to pay poor people. We can, because we need to keep those tax cuts we gave before. So it is a convenient thing, which is, I think, used politically rather than, I don't think most of the politicians actually believe that. Like, well, I think the smarter ones at least know that that's not true, and use it as a convenient tool rather than as a.
As a realistic, argument,
but for now, say in Australia, they have to do the education now of the less bright backbenchers who are like, no, this was my talking point from 3 years ago. No.
Yeah,
it's
right.
Now the talking point is debts don't matter.
Yeah,
you know, or just don't mention them. You know, that's fine. Yeah. We've got to do it to get the economy out. So I think there's, within Australia at least, because you've got the Liberal. It's a good thing to have a Liberal Party in at this point, because then. The Labor Party is going to back them to bigger deficits every stage, and then they can convince their own, you know, their own people to do it. Whereas the flip side, you probably would have seen if exactly the same thing happened, but with parties the other way around.
Yeah.
You probably would have seen a bunch of complaints about, oh, that's too big, you're spending too much money.
Yep.
You know, it's
Yeah, no, it's an interesting one though, isn't it? You know, obviously the people we've spoken to on the show and MMT, and you know the way that, you know, the fiscal system works and where the money comes from is, I think, it's sort of a little bit lacking on Main Street, and you know you still get this the big debt push. Everyone's worried about debt, you know, and obviously it makes sense at a household level, as you say, but not so much at a federal level.
it's so easy to appeal to people's heartstrings because pretty much everyone's got a mortgage. Right?
Yeah, that's
right. We're all very mortgage indebted in this country,
and no one likes having a mortgage. That's the goal. Get rid of it.
Yeah. So, look, you know, Costello very sneakily, I think Peter Costello, when he was treasurer, you know, tried to equate the budget as to the nation's mortgage.
Mm.
And I remember the day they finally paid off the debt. They said we paid off the nation's mortgage. And then that kind of gives that perception that it works like a household balance.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So it's just a very easy trick.
Yep. Yeah. Mm. Very good.
I'll jump. There's a question out there about the budget influence on our allocations. We'll flip that to the end.
Thanks, Phil.
Yeah. Anyway.
We've got some on some land price. We haven't really touched too much on land prices.
Maybe we'll leave that one to the end.
Maybe we'll leave that
well.
To the end as well. Okay, thanks, yeah. Darren. Yep, no worries. All right.
Yeah. So basically, I guess the bottom line of that is don't fret the debt. It's a good political slogan.
Yeah. And so one argument against this would be, but interest rates will start rising, and so that debt cost will go up over time.
And dramatically, because of the expansion of the debt level.
The interest rates are so low that, if the average 10-year rate... Well, actually, the thing is, though, as well, what you don't get in is what the government's actually funding at the moment. Like, when you look at the actual debt, there's a lot of it that was issued at 3%, 4%, 5%.
Right.
And so...
rolling off and...
And that's still... Yeah, that's still being worked down. So part of this reflects, even if interest rates are rising... you're rolling off expensive debt at 4% and putting on new debt at, say, which is higher, but it might be 10-year debt that's, say, it's at 2.5% or 3%, which is higher than where it is today.
But net.
But it's lower than the stuff that it's replacing. Yeah. And so, you know, while that interest bill, you know, if interest rates go back to 4% or 5%, then yes, that interest bill should up significantly. Mm. But if they go back to sort of 2% or 3%, there's probably not a lot of change in that debt over the you know, the next few years, because you're just rolling that off. And then the other issue is obviously that with those, if you are forecasting that interest rates going back to 4% or 5%, is that yes, it'll smash the Australian government deficit. But if you're forecasting that as well, that's going to smash houses who have all loaded up into households who all have big deficits. And you're basically saying there's going to be a massive recession. Mm. Interest rates are going to go up for a massive recession. And that's the you've got to sort of disconnect between those two. But debt levels are so high now that it's actually for not just government but for consumers and corporates as well, that it's very hard to raise interest rates without actually causing recessions.
Yeah, and of course the piggy in the middle is inflation. Hmm. The only way it's ever going to go up is inflation needs to be up and sustained for the base rate to cash rate to go up anyway. So
yeah, but also
inflate away the debt.
That's right. So obviously higher inflation means higher
but you can't go
GDP in dollar terms. Then inflates away your debt anyway.
Yeah, but you can't raise. Yeah, so you need the inflation first and for a sustained period before you can competently raise rates without crashing the entire show.
And what typically happens for governments coming out of, say, wars, where there's these massive debt burdens that they've got to do is you get financial repression. You get low interest rates and high inflation or high-ish inflation, and you just eat away at that debt until you get to the stage where you can go back to... But it's an engineered financial repression to get you back to the stage where... And so you can make the argument that no, that shouldn't be the case. Interest rates should go back to the natural level and all that. But if that crashes the economy, well, they're not going to come back to the... Yeah, they won't go back to the natural level.
And in the meantime, you've probably got runaway house price inflation anyway because the debt's so low and everyone's getting paid more and off she goes. So anyway, good point there. Do we have a couple other slides? I feel like we've skipped a couple there.
No, I think there's only one more, which is the whole big Australia thing, which we kind of already touched upon. So basically, Treasury, negative net overseas migration this year, negative next financial year. Back to 90-something thousand the year after that, and then back to big Australia. So back to pre-COVID, back to big population growth, back to traffic jams, back to more expensive rents, back to low productivity growth, back to low wage growth.
Don't sound too excited, mate.
Well, I'm just saying that was the empirical evidence of the past decade.
Yep.
Anyone who lives in the city of Melbourne knows it. The economic data doesn't lie. But unfortunately, the Australian Treasury wants it back.
Well, so, business lobbies want it back.
No, the Australian Treasury does too.
Right.
So unfortunately, the RBA has flipped. The RBA is basically now starting to caution against it because they want wage growth. Whereas Treasury is still out there saying that, you know, big levels of immigration are good. We need to return to it. So that's anyone who's been reading macro business knows have been hitting the issue pretty hard in the last few weeks, and that's why, because I think this is the current fight to not go back to a stupid policy that didn't serve us very well.
It just doesn't sound like it's going to be politically that favourable anyway. Like, I understand there's obviously Treasury and the business lobbies are on side for it, but It doesn't sound, it doesn't feel like anyway that, you know, the general public, unless something happens where high immigration is the answer and it's so obvious that it needs to be, you know, the tap needs to be ripped back open again.
I think you're too close to the problem there, Tim. You recognise the problem and have been there for years.
Yeah.
So whereas I think my personal view is that, look, the average person in the street will take at face value what government of the day is telling them.
Yeah,
and if they decide to tell them that we need this unemployment, we need this employment, and the Treasury's saying it, there's a whole bunch of it. We're employing all these economists out there and they're telling us to turn it back on again. So it'll probably be good for me. Mm. So I think...
And I don't want to give many ideas, but the government can always use a scare tactic. They can say we need to get the immigration back to keep inflation down.
Mm.
Otherwise, mortgage rates have to go up.
Yeah,
and that could be used as a scare campaign, because we know that there's nothing Australians love more than rising property prices, and nothing they're more scared of is rising mortgage rates.
And the other thing is they don't have to admit it as well. I mean, that's the other thing, is what we've seen a lot of, especially in the Howard years, even in the last few, you know, Abbott Turnbull Morrison years, is that you'd be really harsh on refugees and maybe you're really harsh on whatever, quarantines or whatever. You pick something that you want to be really harsh on and make that the big, everyone's watching this thing over here, that look how harsh we're being, this, and we're not letting these ones in and all that type of stuff. And in the meantime, you're just like through the back door, you're just funneling as many people as you can.
Airports of chockers.
Yeah. And so that's a bait and switch is I'd say, you know, that's probably my baseline, at the moment. And I guess why I was quizzing Leith, and as we spoke before, is, you know, coming to that investment part, is that we really don't know what's going to happen. At the moment, the stated thing is they will turn it back on again. As I said, you're trying to build up momentum for this. No, look, everything's actually going quite well. Will you build up enough momentum for that? Maybe. But, usually what happens when vested interests and their money...
Yep.
Meet good policy is the vested interests
can win.
So I guess that's sort of leading back to this, you know, does the budget influence any significant changes to our asset allocation?
Yeah, great.
That's probably the key one that we're looking at in terms of, will that actually make an effect?
Mm.
By and large, budgets don't actually affect the investment markets anywhere near as much as what you think they might.
Yeah.
I think that the major thing we were worried about with this budget is a push for austerity. That would have been if it was all about saying, no, we need to get this back into surpluses. As quickly as possible, then that would have been a sign that, look, time to get right out of Australia and get into overseas.
Hmm.
We are actually pushing that angle already, moving out of Australian assets and into overseas, not in a huge way, but we're certainly tilting that way. But that's on the back of other factors. That's not a budget type thing. I think from the budget perspective, the big issue was, will they stuff it up? And the answer is no. They haven't gone for that down that route. So you go, okay, that's the main tick.
Mm.
The question now is, are they spending enough money to actually grow faster than other countries, and spending enough? And I guess that's the part where I'm uncertain about it. I think the answer is no, for the reasons I spoke about earlier, that a lot of it is the front-loaded things. It's not a lot of infrastructure and other...
Long-tail sort of...
And it's not stuff that I think will actually end up... It's not
productivity enhancing.
Exactly. And the stuff where it is productivity enhancing for companies is saying, okay, we're going to build an Apple picker. We're going to import an Apple picker and a robotic one, and we'll put that to work. And so we've just spent a few million dollars, and now we've saved ourselves on wages and all that type of stuff.
Yep.
That actually doesn't do a lot for the Australian economy. Like, if you've just gone and shelled out a few million dollars to an overseas robotics manufacturer,
yep,
and you've now capped your wage rises in Australia, and it's productivity enhancing. It's a good thing to, much prefer to see people out there doing other things rather than backbending labour and basic tasks. So it's a good thing from that perspective, but there's not a lot of economic benefit you can point back to saying, okay, we've spent this big money and we got this return for it. Whereas I think a lot of some of the infrastructure ones, maybe some of the childcare stuff, I think you can see returns on that.
Yep.
So there are things in there in the budget to do that. But I guess when I look at the Australian budget relative to, say, what looks like it's coming out of the US, it is quite different in terms of the amount of money being spent on infrastructure and productivity enhancing broad big picture ideas, you know. And I think even if you know, there's obviously lots of complaints about something like the NBN, for example, about the rollout and all these issues and the net effect, but the net effect is the fact that you did something was far better than doing nothing or just hoping companies would do something over that period. That investment will actually, you know, create productivity that enabled, well, it did create productivity that enabled Australia to get through this pandemic by doing a lot of stuff from home. Whereas if you had, you know, copper lines everywhere still, you probably would have, you wouldn't have had anywhere near as much benefit from the work from home. So there's things if we had seen more of that coming out in terms of saying, here is some big picture ideas and some big picture developments about what we're doing and you can see where that's going to benefit, then I would have been happier. But, you know, the question is the budget a bad budget? No, it's not a bad budget. Definitely could have been better, and I can see where places could have been better, but it's not enough to affect your investment.
It's not a step in the wrong direction, essentially.
Not affect your asset allocation is pretty much going to stay relatively similar, regardless of whether it was a bit better or a bit worse than where it is. It was just a matter of saying, if they had have stuffed up and gone the austerity route, it would have been right. Now's the time to flip right out of Australia and get elsewhere.
So
basically, the quantity of spending was about right. It's just whether or not the quality could have been better.
Yes.
So they got the quantity part right. Like, they didn't go the austerity route, but again, the quality could have been better. Which is basically my assessment on budget nine. I think it right went up at 9:30 PM, and that was my quick take. Was, you know, mostly right. And generally, when I write up these things, I go in with very negative. So I go in expecting the worst. So when I don't get the worst, I'm happy. And that's basically happened this time. I was just waiting to be disappointed. So I thought it was, you know, as far as what I was expecting, it was pretty good.
And I'm hopeful, but not expecting it. Is that it does? You know, they've obviously flipped around to say, okay, we've decided now deficits aren't bad necessarily. Is it maybe they will change a few other things like the immigration and things like that, because they're obviously you know, some navel gazing and thinking about it, and so I'm hopeful that'll happen, but which is a bad thing for some companies, or it could be a very bad thing for some companies, but good for other ones. But that's yet to be seen. I think that's very much up in the air, and so, you know, I wouldn't want to jump either way from an investment perspective on that theme yet.
So going forward then, I guess, the budget's a step in the right direction, or at least not, you know, not a sign for alarm. Is there anything sort of else in the Australian economic landscape just sort of coming forward?
Yeah, so we'll preempt next week's show. So we're going to, we've got some quite a long and involved argument about inflation and what's going on in inflation, and quite a contrary one to what you're seeing in the some of the popular press.
Okay.
And so we think that's a much bigger deal than anything coming out of the budget. And so that's really going to drive inflation, and what's happening not just in Australia but globally is really going to drive investments over the next 6 to 12 months and probably for the next few years.
Right.
Yep. And so we've got quite a contrary view, and we're going through we're starting to make changes in the portfolio for it, but it's one of those ones which is we have a path of here's what we're going to do if it unfolds the way we're expecting it to. But it's not a flip everything today and do it. It's a gradual, right, you take a little bit and then make sure things are still going in that direction, and then you move a little bit more, and then you move a little bit more, and you know, eventually get to the point where
Measured steps. Okay. Well, there you go. Well, that's the coming up next week component of the show covered off. Thank you, David. Thanks for that. There was a question there just around land prices. So when do you see land prices lowering? 1,200 a square metre is way overpriced 2 hours from Sydney City. I guess if we just sort of look broadly at a national level, we've got a Prime Minister pretty committed to house prices.
Yeah, so. Look, unfortunately, I think policy's not going to help you out there. You know, you might get a land price lowering if we have like a cyclical bust in the property market. But at the moment, everything's basically conspiring against that. Whether that's the obviously the planning laws, you got the easy credit, blah blah blah, and also you've got the government has just subsidised the hell out of new builds, and there's still some subsidies there for new builds, which is obviously helps inflate the land market in out of suburban areas by increasing demand. So. Yeah, I'm not sure. Look, it's
Which is an interesting way, yeah. From an economist, it's interesting, isn't it? Because you're sort of saying, and I'm not disagreeing with this. I think it's right, but it's a part about saying, we're going to go and build a lot more houses, and so that's actually going to be bad for the affordability. And you're like, well, why is that bad for affordability? Surely increasing supply should be good for affordability. But the problem is, as you said, it's the slow land release and the restrictive planning practices, which mean you're
and also we've got a developer cartel. So they've got basically, you know,
we're bleating at the moment.
Yeah, stock land, etc. They've all got, you know, 14, 15 years of supply in the pipeline, which they can drip feed. So
So there's a bit about the property tax changes, say in Victoria. So good and bad, I guess, within that at the moment that's being leaked out. I mean, I suppose it's been trial ballooned. I guess they're thinking this is what we're thinking about doing. Let's pop it out in the press and see how much pushback we get, and then we'll decide how much we really do.
Actually, I think it's pretty much formally been announced now. Yeah. Look, it's mostly good. It's got two goods and one bad. Mm. So the best thing about it is they're going to do a tax on value uplift. So what that means is if you're someone who owns a rural block in the middle of nowhere, and the government then zones you residential, well, you get a massive uplift in the value of your land, and that can breed corruption as well. Mm. So basically, you get this massive windfall gain that's only come about because of a stroke of a pen from a government saying that your land is suddenly worth that.
Yep.
So the Victorian government wants to charge a tax of up to 50%. Mm-hmm. So basically, the taxpayers will get half of that value uplift, which is actually sensible.
Yeah, and that's one. Cameron's been pushing that for ages.
Yeah, he has. Yeah,
Cameron Murray,
yeah,
who's a frequent visitor, frequent guest on our show here.
Yeah, Cameron's the author of Game of Mates, which talks about all this sort of stuff, and he proposed 75% value uplift, so it's a lot lower than that.
It's something. You're off zero.
Yeah, they should have made it 10 and then just walked it up over the next.
That's it. I'm not saying it's bad because it's 75%. It's actually excellent. But so that was that was one of the excellent policies. The other one was they want to lift the land tax on investment property holdings, investment property owners who own a lot of property, so like own multi-million dollars worth.
Yep.
Which I think is a good move because they're obviously going to be the wealthiest people in the state. They're obviously benefiting the most from rising property prices, etc. It's unearned wealth. So that's a good move. Land tax is also incredibly efficient. The bad one to come out of it is that they've gone the complete opposite direction from New South Wales in that they've actually increased the stamp duty on houses over $2 million. So basically Victoria already had the most expensive stamp duty in the country. We're the most reliant state on stamp duty. And they've basically increased that reliance on the least efficient tax, which is kind of stupid. Whereas at the same time, New South Wales, obviously our biggest state, has gone the opposite direction, and they're phasing out stamp duty in favour of land tax, which is the most efficient tax.
Yeah.
So what I would have loved to have seen is both the two biggest states in the country, Victoria copying New South Wales, taking the same approach, and then that probably would have driven a national move away from stamp duty because all the smaller states probably would have followed. You would have had New South Wales, Victoria, ACT all doing that.
So the ACT's already got that in.
Yeah, they do.
They're working it in over a 20-year period.
Yep. Whereas New South Wales, basically every new property, you can either elect to pay stamp duty or land tax, but once that property's gone that road, it can never go back to, once it's resold, it must stay in that land tax system.
Mm. Yeah. But for me though, In a way, like so one of the key arguments against a stamp duty is that it overtly benefits wealthy people who buy big blocks of land and then live on it forever and never actually downsize or anything. So somebody goes and you've got a family, you buy a 4-bedroom house and you raise your family and all that type of stuff, and then the kids all move out and then the husband dies and the wife's left in this 4-bedroom mansion type thing and never downsizes. Yep. And so, but that's actually very financially beneficial for that person because they don't have to pay any stamp duty for that entire period. Mm. Whereas the poor person who has to, starts with a 1-bedroom and goes to a 2-bedroom and then moves up to a 3-bedroom and then finally 4-bedroom, they get more kids and then do the right thing and move downsize once the kids have moved out, they pay stamp duty every single time. They have to move anyway.
Right. Yeah.
And so to me, the way New South Wales is doing it is basically saying, well, the first person gets to benefit as much as they can. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The second person will smooth it out, but you're still going to be paying. They're still going to be paying effectively for all the, because, and the argument is, that the second person pays for your schools and your hospitals and all these things that they're paying for by having the stamp duty. is that person still paying? Because they're the one who couldn't afford to pay the stamp duty up front and weren't going to, you know, and they did gradually, you know, they couldn't afford a $5 million house straight away or whatever, the expensive house straight away. So they've gradually worked their way up to it and had to pay. They're still paying. So they're still paying for all your nurses and hospitals and.
Yeah, totally agree. But anyway, the New South Wales reforms are basically a reflection of it's got to be. You got to get over the line politically.
Yeah.
So sure. it was, you know, ideally you'd say, okay, from this date forward, everyone pays the land tax, right?
Yeah.
But then you'll never get that through because everyone will kick and scream. But,
yeah.
But the you are right. The problem with stamp duty is basically you've got 5% of people. So roughly, that's homes right. turn over about 1 in 20 homes turns over on average.
Yep.
A year. It changes year by year.
Yeah.
But about 1 in 5. So you've got basically 5% of the population. Paying the taxes,
financing
to support the other 95%.
Yeah.
When really it should be everyone pays the tax,
yeah.
and you all pay a small share.
Yeah, and usually it's the most, it's not your most vulnerable people, but it's your people who have just had kids or just had life changing events, divorced, yeah. whatever it is,
or downsizing,
who are actually financially in the worst position to be funding the taxes for everyone else because they're yep. just like, yeah, I'm just starting slogged. A family and yeah. and they're the ones slogging it for the...
Yeah, it's got a lock-in effect. It stops people moving. It disincentives them to move to where if they need to move close to their job.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
It's, you know, transaction taxes are pretty stupid because they do influence behavior a lot, whereas a tax on a movable property
yep.
Like a land tax doesn't. Yeah. You can't change behavior.
So I guess what I'm saying... Sufficient. I guess where I'm going to is I think the New South Wales one is... Said it's a step forward, but they need to keep going. It can't end up being that's all you do, and you end up with two classes of people: other people who are landed, you landed gentry who bought it 20 years ago and aren't paying anything, and everyone else who's coughing up to pay for the people who aren't moving.
I'll be perfectly honest, right? I've obviously written articles slamming the Victorian government for keeping stamp duty, but me personally, I'm happy. So because I bought my biggest home I'm ever going to own 7 years ago.
Yeah.
And I'm not planning to move for the next 30 years unless I move to Queensland, which fingers crossed might happen. But but if I stay in Victoria, I'm not going to be moving for 30 years. So I'll be freeloading off everyone else.
Yep. Yep.
But I can accept that that's wrong and it's not the way the tax system should be operating.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, the poor sod who moves 3 or 4 times through... for whatever reason, they're paying tax to support me.
Yeah.
It's not right.
And that's the reason why it works so well at a local council level as well, because you know they're incentivized to make the council or make the area or the borough or the area more livable and more enjoyable, and therefore people want to move there and pay more in prices, and they actually just get a small slice of that pie, of that investment every time. So it makes a lot of sense. I don't know how well it works at state level. Yeah. But
I haven't seen any noises out of other states on that front.
No, and that's the thing. I reckon if Victoria had gone the New South Wales route, it would have put a lot of pressure, I think, on the small states, because you've got basically half the nation's population would be under this new regime. But unfortunately, because Victoria's gone the other way and they've actually increased their reliance on it,
for everyone else to do.
So it's a real missed opportunity. And I also blame the federal government here, because the federal government, one of the reasons why states don't like doing these reforms is because the federal government captures the productivity benefits. So if there are productivity gains, it tends to flow through to company and personal taxes through one way, shape, or form. The federal government benefits. The state's got to obviously wear the cost if there's a short-term revenue hit like there is for New South Wales. So the federal government should be really giving incentive payments to the states to undertake these kind of reforms.
Yeah.
But again...
Well, and it was actually, leadership. In a way, it was a bit of a golden opportunity as well to sort of say, you need to spend a lot of money. Why don't you actually flip everyone to a land tax system and reward the states, you know, by basically saying, okay, we'll pay you a bunch of money now up front for the money you've lost by stamp duty, and then gradually work that down over the next 10 years. And, you know, there's actually a ready-made stimulus payment for directly to states that are going to spend it.
And the federal government used to do that with competition payments. You remember those in the 1990s? It was incentive payment to force competition reforms at the state level. I don't know. I don't understand why they don't do it now. It's just such an easy solution to a lot of things, and they basically get buy-in from the states and encourage this sort of productivity-enhancing reform. So anyway, I've banged on long enough, but it's basically, it was a missed opportunity.
Yep. And and the net answer is there's not a lot you can see on the horizon policy-wise that's going to pull back housing prices. It'll have to be something else. It'll have to be a policy mistake, effectively. If you want to see house prices fall, it's probably a policy mistake in terms of not enough stimulus or raising rates too quickly, as opposed to
a deliberate policy.
Let's try and slow the housing market down. Yeah, let's try and bring back affordability.
We're very likely to see it's a 0.1% chance we'll see a New Zealand government style tax on investors, etc. Because Labor tried it last election, failed, and it's not likely to be repeated.
Yeah, and then the next, and obviously, if New Zealand, but the benefit is we have this New Zealand experiment going on, which is saying what happens to economy, a very similar economy to Australia with actually the same banks that, that you know, all the banking systems, effectively the Australian banking system is, so it doesn't work though, then there's a, you'll probably never see this reform in Australia. And if it does work, but we're at least 4 or 5 years away from getting to the stage where you can see enough evidence for them to say, yes, it did work.
Yep.
Enough to start putting
probably
it through.
Probably be a new government as well, no doubt. We'll wait and see how it goes. But very good. Okay, gents. Well, I think that's probably time. So thanks for coming in, Leith. And
no problem.
Giving us a terrific run through on federal, and then we'll even hinted on state budget towards the end there. Thanks to you, Damien, as well. Thanks to our guys that asked questions. Darren, I'm sorry, probably not the answer you were looking for, but that's the way it goes. Our viewer question of the week for you guys, of course, is what do you think the budget missed? So a fairly broad range of topics there, but always interested to hear your thoughts on some areas that may not have been covered off in this budget and you would have liked to have seen. So thanks again for all of those who've watched in live for another great episode, and of course to those who asked questions. Hope you've taken away some great ideas, and if you haven't already, feel free to click like on the video now to give us some feedback. If you'd like to see more of our content, head over to nucleuswealth.com/content. To stay up to date on news from us, follow us on social media. And finally, if you know anyone who gets something out of today's episode, let them know about it, share with a friend, and help our show grow. Thanks again for tuning in from myself, Tim Fuller, and the team, and we look forward to catching you with the next one. Cheers.